So first day, how many of you are PSI students? Just to know. Okay. First day, oh, you too, good, good. First day of this relativistic quantum information course. Before we start or anything, how many of you, I mean, I guess all of you, but I'm not sure what course you've seen, how many of you are confident they know relativity? How many of you are confident that you know, you're not confident, Scarlett? Oh, you are. How many of you are confident that they know quantum field theory? Okay, how many of you know a bit of quantum field theory at least? Good. How many of you are confident you know quantum information? All right, good. That was helpful. So we're going to have this little introduction to relativistic quantum information. I mean, relativistic quantum information is such a broad area. It's relatively new, didn't exist before the 2000s. And it's like very, very kind of that very diverse topics. So I'm going to try to give you a little bit of an introduction and cover some interesting, if you want, parts of it. But keep in mind that what I tell you is just the bare beginning. And also, apologies if anyone gets offended that we're not mentioned in here, because again, the field is such a huge, huge, huge sea and ocean, right, that it's very difficult to cover it all. So let's talk a little bit about what this is, relativistic quantum information. So relativistic quantum information is, by the way, I didn't say, probably read it, I'm Eduardo, nice to meet you all. I'm a professor at the University of Waterloo, also affiliate here. And relativistic quantum information is my main field of research. Relativistic quantum information, as you probably suspect already because of the things I asked you, is on the interface of these three fields: general relativity, quantum field theory, and quantum information, and has two sides, if you want. One is, can we harness relativity or relativistic approaches, taking into account relativity, to do more in quantum information processing than what you can do only with non-relativistic quantum theory. And the second one is, can we actually use the knowledge from quantum information and if you want the interaction of light and matter to learn more about space-time and the quantum nature of gravity? And this is kind of the core of what this course is going to be. How can actually we learn more or different or something else that about the structure of space-time using tools coming from quantum information? So a little like quick review on fundamental topics that relativistic quantum information deals with. Well, again, I'm listing things that I've worked in. Many people would say, oh, but what about, causal ordering and causal process matrix formalisms? Yes, definitely, that's also RQI, relativistic quantum information. But again, I'm gonna talk only about a little glimpse, and hopefully at the end of the course, we can discuss a little bit about other things as well. So cosmology, yeah, for example, one question you can ask: how much can we learn about the early universe if we actually do experiments nowadays? That's a legitimate question. And people in astrophysics will tell you, well, we have some ways, and we can answer, well, are those all the ways that you can actually use? Can we actually use something else? For example, can we see what happened in the early universe, just not looking just at light, but looking at something else? This is something that I'm gonna cover in this course in particular detail as well. Of course, there's the problem, the black hole information loss problem, right? I mean, if you know quantum mechanics, you know that quantum mechanics cannot destroy information, right? Quantum mechanics can scramble, information can be scrambled. Well, I mean, it depends on at what level you believe quantum mechanics is a good description. I don't know what your opinions are, but if you believe that whatever you call the universe is ruled by quantum mechanics and there's nothing else, then we know that at some level we will have unitarity. And the reason we don't have information is because it's lost to an environment, if you want. If you call the universe all that big environment, sometimes this is called the larger unitary church kind of belief. Basically, if you believe in quantum mechanics, information cannot be destroyed. What it could happen with it is get scrambled, very difficult to recover, lost in the environment, shredded like a paper shredder kind of thing. That's the way quantum mechanics hides information from you, making it tough to put it together. But then what happens with black holes? What happens with information? If black holes even exist, I mean, we got a picture of something that looks like it, but then again, you know that that's not kind of fair. We cannot claim that's a black hole completely with full rigor unless we observe it for all its life, no? If we actually observe it for a little bit, something that looks a lot like a black hole, at the very least. Black holes, if they are like theory predicts, as in if we really have event horizons, what happens with the information? Do they destroy information? Can the information escape in the form of Hawking radiation? Then Hawking radiation, we will talk a little bit about thermality in this course. And talking about thermality, we will talk a little bit about, okay, how much information can escape in the form of Hawking radiation? And at what scale are going to be other effects coming in that cannot be just explained with the usual mechanism of Hawking radiation? How many of you are familiar with Hawking radiation? Okay, nice. We will cover this in a little detail. Hopefully you even have a tutorial on the Andrew effect, which is kind of pre-Hawking radiation if you want, or an intro. Vacuum fluctuations, that's kind of cool. Like if you believe in quantum theory, the vacuum, that means the ground state of a quantum field theory, I mean, calling it empty, empty is a definition. So it of course depends, what do you call empty? But if you go to the quantum optician definition of empty, as in like no particles, no excitations of the field, the ground state, that thing is not quite empty. It's kind of empty on average globally. If your observables are localized, then it might not be empty. And in the sense of like maybe if I have a detector, the detector clicks really, even in the vacuum state. That's kind of what is called in general, and we will make this. Again, in this course, I'm going to try not to wave my hands a lot. I know that exploration courses are supposed to be very hand-wavy. All that I'm saying here right now, I hope to back it up with math. And I hope to back it up with hopefully rigorous explanations. And I want you guys to keep me on check. If I say something outrageous, you should stop me right there and say, no, that doesn't make any sense. And that is going to be super appreciated if you do it. So again, these are like very hand-wavy claims because it's the first lecture. But hopefully as we go, the amount of waving hands will decrease. Spanish people, we tend to wave hands a lot. I'll try to minimize it. Okay. Vacuum fluctuations, again, if you want, detection events that happen because you observe localized observables, even in the ground state of a quantum field theory, those contain information about the structure of space-time. Not only curvature, I write curvature here, but we will even talk about topology, which is something tough to measure. If you live in a flat space-time, can you tell what the topology of the space-time is with not completely global measurements? We'll see about that. And this particular kind of fluctuations, if you want, this particular kind of noise is special. Noise usually is thought of as something that prevents communication. This kind of noise can assist communication. We will talk about it in detail. These are things that, what I mentioned here, most of them we'll talk in some detail. Right. This is going to be fun. Hopefully we'll start with this today. The measurement problem. How familiar are you with the measurement problem? Do you know about it? How many people know about it? It's kind of a tough problem. In quantum mechanics already, it gets much worse when you go relativistic. When you put together relativity and quantum theory, the measurement problem goes crazy, as we will see. And how do we deal with that? And this is related also with how can information be localized? I mean, you may see sometimes people may wave their hands and talk about qubits in space-time. That's kind of trendy to talk about quantum information in space-time, no? As in like relativity and quantum info. When they write a space-time diagram and they say the qubit lives here, right away you should raise your hand and say, oh, hold on, what? What do you mean? Because this thing, where is it? Localization is not here? Oh, yeah, here. Localization is tough in quantum field theory. Very tough. I'm going to like kind of grasp the surface of it. But we will see how talking about information on a qubit living in a particular region of space becomes tough formally. Okay, and we will talk a little bit about all that too. Okay. Oh, of course, thermodynamics. Quantum thermodynamics is a really nice topic. I don't know how much you know about it. It's relatively new too, what is called now quantum thermodynamics. I'm not talking about statistical mechanics of quantum systems. I'm talking about what does it mean to talk about work when you work with quantum systems. Work is not an observable. There's no self-adjoint operator called W that you call work. What does it mean? In classical thermo, it's also not an observable in the physics kind of sense, but you can actually make it work as in like, yeah, work is kind of, in a way, usable energy that you can actually do stuff with, right? And then you talk about adiabaticity and you talk about heat. What all those things mean when we talk about quantum systems, okay? And we'll talk a little bit about that in the context of quantum field theory, okay? Which is super important for information as well. As you know, thermodynamics and information are extremely related, right? Well, I don't know if you agree. If you don't, please, I would love some debate here. Yeah, of course, the big thing, right? Quantum gravity. This is not quantum gravity, relativistic quantum information, but maybe we can contribute a little bit about understanding how these things work together. Gravity, it's funny, there's this, I couldn't find it though because I'm searching by name. This XKCD comic strip that is really good at it. It's a teacher. I don't know what level. It's teaching students, seems like high school or something like that. And the teacher says, in nature, we have four fundamental interactions we know of. Two of them you're already very familiar with. One is gravity, and the students say, yeah, makes sense. The other one is electromagnetism. They say, yeah, sure. And then we have the strong and the weak interaction. Says the strong interaction, it would keeps the nucleus of atoms together, even though they're positively charged. And the students say, no, hold on, how does that work? And then they say, and the weak interaction is responsible for radioactive decay, he says. And they said, what? That doesn't make any sense. And then the teacher says, of all those four interactions, there's one that we had no idea about how it works. And the student asks, OK, is that the strong or the weak one? And the teacher said, no, it's gravity. So this is such a cool topic now. I mean, always been. It's probably the most important challenge in mathematical physics. How do you make gravity and quantum theory work together? It's comparable to kind of the end of the 19th century when people were like, okay, how do you make mechanics and thermodynamics work together? They seem so different, there's no way. It's actually in completely different foundations and the formalism seems different and I don't know, both seem to work, right? How do we make them work together? And hopefully we'll have a new Maxwell, a new Boltzmann, and people like that that will make this thing work together. We've been trying for 100 years now, you know? Seems to be pretty tough. Maybe we're doing something wrong fundamentally, who knows? Oh, I have this here. Oh, this is just to motivate. We'll talk a little bit because I have a Jose here. I put this here. Jose is right there, he's a collaborator of mine. And he's working on things related to this. Can you actually use, it's kind of cool, quantum informational protocols to apply and design stress energy densities in space-time that are custom-made, and then how much can you actually custom-make stress energy densities? Can you actually get like funny solutions of Einstein equations? We will talk a little bit about that. How many of you are familiar with energy conditions in general? Oh, nice, everyone, that's cool. You too, Scarlett, I know that. And you too, yeah. All right. And of course, there's the stuff we're not gonna probably talk about much here, but hopefully in the discussion sessions we'll. Which is very applied things, not just sci-fi applied things, but applied things that you can do in the lab, as in like, can you actually use relativistic aspects of light, for example? Something we will talk a lot about here is what I would call relativistic quantum optics. And when I throw out the name relativistic quantum optics, I get two kind of answers, right? Answer one is, hold on, but isn't that already relativistic because it's light? The answer to that is yes. So you should take that into account when you do stuff with it. The other kind of answer is, oh, why would I care about relativity if in my lab nothing moves really fast? And then the answer to that is pretty obvious. Like, oh, you're right. You're working with light. What speed does this thing go? Your photons go? So relativistic aspects are important. Sometimes, no, I mean, this is kind of, sometimes in quantum optics. And maybe with those aspects, you can actually take advantage and do new things, right? Maybe you can do communication in ways you haven't thought of. Maybe you can measure things that you couldn't measure before. Maybe you can simulate other things, or maybe you can control your system much better, or much worse, who knows, when you do relativity. We will talk a little bit about that. Again, we're not going to delve into the applications in particular. That would be a more applied kind of course. I really want to talk about the fundamentals in this one. But I'm open to questions and discussion all the time. So I'm going to give you something that most of you or some of you may know, because I've shown you, I've shown all the people who have taken courses with me, and all the people who went to the talk I gave here before may have seen this. So if you know the answer, you're not allowed to participate. How many people know how to solve Bell's rocket paradox? At least waving hands. How many people do not? Nice. So at least to some people, let's have some fun. And let's remember, because this thing is going to be tutorial one
tomorrow.
So doing the math of it, not for the people who already done it, but for the people that are in PSI, that's going to be something you're going to have to solve doing the math, right? So it's a kind of a fun problem. Again, let's set up the scenario. This is the place where mathematical physics lives. This is the place, again, spherical chaos, mass zero, and so on. And then you have two rockets tied with a rope. The two rockets lift off with the same proper acceleration. And then we have a question, which is, does the rope break or not? OK? And why? And again, every time I show this, I say, careful with whys. Physics doesn't really answer whys. Physics answer hows. Physics models, right? And then the why is kind of our minds trying to do philosophy with the models. You know that? If you want to know more about that, search on YouTube, Feynman about magnets. Great video about this topic. Like, physics doesn't really answer whys. But then again, we tend to give what usually we spend a lot of time doing whys, right? And then we call it phenomenology, and we are satisfied with it, even though it's kind of philosophy. But all right. So you have two rockets. And the x-axis is the direction of motion. OK, this is height, is x. And they lift off with the same proper acceleration. They're supposed to be hyperbolas. Of course, they start at some zero speed, at time zero, and they move at the speed of light at infinite time, because they keep accelerating. And then we look at it from the point of view of observers on Earth. And you get that at time t1, the two rockets are at the same separation. At time t2, the two rockets are at the same separation, of course. So you conclude the rope doesn't break because the two rockets are moving at the same speed. Okay. Now we look at it from the point of view of one of the rockets. And the place of simultaneity I'm drawing here for rocket 1. Of course, as the rocket accelerates, the place is exaggerated. This is not done with the equation, so it's super exaggerated. This speed doesn't seem to, like the tangent would be like this. Okay, so the tangent, probably the plane of simultaneity would be less angle, but you go with me, right? So at T1, this is the plane of simultaneity. At T2, this is the plane of simultaneity. Oh my god, the other rocket is going further away. You are the pilot of rocket 1. You call the second rocket and say, you guys, slow down. What the heck? I mean, you're getting further away from us. I'm going at 9.8 meters per second squared, and you're going at 10 or 11 or 12 or whatever. And then the other rocket says, what do you mean? No, you slow down. You're the one who's going further away and things like that. If we do the same construction for the other one, it would be exactly the same. So these people would conclude that the rope will break. And the why is very easy, is because, you know, the other rocket is just going further away from me. It's accelerating more than I am. So putting tension on the rope, and it will break it. OK, those of you who don't know the answer, which is very few, though, how many people would vote for the rope breaks? How many people would vote for doesn't break? You see, it's super interesting. I always say it. And this is statistically confirmed. I've done this a lot of times. But when you, I've done it in popular science, and I've done it with physicists. Now, when you get this to popular science, to people who don't know physics, the answer is 50-50, which makes sense. That means no information at all. They just don't know. Now, physicists, on the other hand, if they know relativity, they all say that the rope doesn't break. It's amazing, like overwhelmingly, which means you have a lot of information, only that information is wrong. It's unbelievable. This is a thing. Everyone, this is not, everyone thinks that the rope actually doesn't break for some reason. Now, here's the thing. So you tend to value the perspective of the person on Earth and their philosophy, how they kind of explain it, which is, oh yeah, they are the same distance, right? So than the other one. So you see, in relativity, all the observations are valid. They're all correct, you know? So if one person sees the other rocket going away, it's not an illusion. The other rocket is going away. You know what I mean? So we should value the two things on the same footing, right? Let's do phenomenology, as in, like, let's interpret, let's try to find whys, right? Yeah, for the accelerated observer, it's very easy. It's because the rocket B is faster than us. for the other reference frame, okay, we have an extended object, right, which is a rope that is accelerating. So if you're on Earth and you try to measure the length, you can measure two things. You can measure the separation between the two rockets, call it L. You can measure the length of the rope, call it D. You put mirrors on the rockets, you put mirrors on the rope, you send laser pulses. This is something that you can measure, the distances, right? And then you say, okay, the two rockets, definitely, they keep the same distance between them. And then the length of the rope, oh, the length of the rope is not D. It's kind of a gamma factor going on, because this thing is an extended object that is accelerating. There's a length contraction effect. So the length of the rope, for me, measured on Earth, is going to be shorter than the separation of the rockets. Therefore, the two rockets are putting tension on the rope, and it will break. So quick answer. Right, so that's the phenomenology, if you want, from the point of, and which solves the paradox. Paradoxes in relativity are, it seems that it should be contradictory, but it's not. It's just a reflection of we don't know how to do it properly. When you do it properly, no paradox whatsoever. Relativity is the most consistent theory ever. So, fantastic. So, yeah, the rope definitely breaks, and it can be explained from the two points of view. But here's the point. While we have only one kind of physics, we have different kinds of phenomenology. And this is super important. And we will see how this, oh, by the way, if you want to see the math of that, you will in the tutorial. Some of you that took relativity with me in the right year have done it as well. You haven't, though. Yeah. All right, again, same as usual. So a typical problem, and I know some of you have seen that already, is that when we do quantum information, oftentimes people talk about the wrong things. And we're going to talk a little bit, hopefully, about projective measurements today and measurements in general. And people talk about entanglement from the point of view of kind of a spooky action kind of description. And of course, we know that in relativity, simultaneity is relative. It's one of the things that is not absolute, right? So what happens first depends on who you ask. You have three observers here at the position of B with different relative speeds to each other, and they disagree on what happens first, A or C. Agreed, everyone? So of course, A and C are simultaneous for B co-moving with A and C, whereas like you have a right moving B, and that sees A happening after C, yes? And the one moving on the opposite in the opposite direction sees A happening before C. So when we have entanglement, right, that's the thing that drove many people crazy, many intelligent people crazy, like Einstein and Bose, and kind of, and Podolsky and Rosen. And here's the thing, and many others, like everyone, it was super trendy to discuss. The same way that people talk about ADS CFT nowadays, they talked about entanglement back there. When thinking about it, it's kind of the same discussion. Anyway, so if you see, again, I always say this in particular because this is a prime example. This is a New York Times. This is a prime example how popular science can do things right and horrible at the same time. Because you see, Einstein attacks quantum theory. Right, the sensational headline, because Einstein is a public figure. Everyone knows Einstein. And he's attacking quantum theory, and that's a cool headline, so let's have it there. That happens all the time. I don't know if you follow the science news lately. There's this discussion about Wigner's friend and an experiment involving Wigner's friend that people make a lot of fuss about. It's super sensational stuff, what they've done. Don't believe anything you read about it, or at least anything that you read about it on the newspapers. Here's something that is kind of correct. Believe a whole. So here, fine, it is not complete, even though correct. It's kind of nice. Believe a whole description of the physical reality can be provided eventually. This is kind of really OK. But here's the biggest problem with this. Scientists and two colleagues, seriously? Like, of course, I know, scientists, that's Einstein, and some other people. I mean, I don't know, maybe they are like, who knows, like business people or something, the stock market. But definitely the scientists, Einstein and two colleagues, right? Fine is not complete, even though, what the heck? So they're using the authority argument here that, oh, Einstein will attract more readers. And if you ever do popular science, be careful of all that. Entanglement. Again, super important to distinguish entanglement from quantum correlations. Many people kind of get super excited about the fact, oh, but look, I make a measurement here, and then I can guess the measurement of the other person. right? Well, that's not impressive at all, right? That doesn't require quantum theory. You can, again, the example, typical example, put black and a white ball in a bag, then just I ask you to pick one, and I'm not looking. No way I'm gonna, like, I'm not looking. Just pick one, don't show me. And then I take the bag to Alpha Centauri, and then I look at my, I just make a measurement on my ball. I say it's black, and I send you a message, and I say, yeah, your ball is white. And then you measure, and it's white. And it's like, oh my God, how did you, it's quantum stuff. No. This is what correlations are. Agreed? So it's not the fact that I can make a measurement, local measurement on A, and guess the outcome of B is not surprising. No one would be impressed about that, right? OK, because there are classical correlations in it. Now, the problem comes, or the kind of cool aspect of non-classical correlations, entanglement in particular, is that you can have locally random outcomes, like a pair of dice in here, two sets of dice. And then you pick one set of dice, you throw it, you get a 10, and then you can guess what the outcome of the other one. You throw yours, is going to be a 4 or whatever, right? Or an 8, as I have here. Now, the problem with this is that many people describe it as, oh, makes sense, right? We have something like 1 root 2, 0 plus 1, or 0, 0 plus 1, 1. Then I measure on A, right? And then because I, by measuring and getting a 0, I'm applying a projector, 0, 0, right? Then I project the whole state. The state is no longer entangled. The state has no probability of getting a 1 when the other person measures. And that kind of way of understanding it is so horrible, but it's the one that sells newspapers. This is an example. It's a real portal called Popular Science. It's not just generic popular science. But look at this. I know, I do it all the time, but this is like kind of prime example of what not to do. It's got all the buzzwords here. Entanglement, breakthrough, yeah, breakthrough is cool. Could lead to unhackable internet. Yeah, internet's kind of a cool thing. Unhackable, nice, people may like that. Particles don't obey the same rules as people. I love that statement. All right. Poke a particle and another one far away can instantly respond to the touch without any messages passing through the space between as if the two particles were one. Entanglement is what quantum physics calls. And of course, you need to learn this for your quantum theory course. It's the first thing you start. It's what we call the intimate connection, right? Everyone knows that. Einstein called it spooky. That is correct. To his dying day, he refused to believe that nature could be so unreasonable. That is so correct. Einstein believed that nature couldn't be so unreasonable in general. As in, like, entanglement was one of the things. By the way, black holes was another of the things. Einstein never believed black holes were a thing. He believed that the theory he made predicted black holes. He just thought they were not a thing astrophysically because nature couldn't be so unreasonable. Anyway, that's interesting and tells you a lot. Right, so that explanation is at odds, of course, with relativity because the collapse of the wave function is such a horrible, horrible crime that if I could go back in time and change one thing in quantum theory, I would change that part of the Copenhagen way of doing science. Projective measurements don't have fundamental value, and we will talk about it next, hopefully. And I'm being outrageous on purpose, and I want people to try to defend it to me, if you might. If someone measures with a projective measurements, and that's what causes B to measure a 1 or a 0, then who collapses the wave function? Is it A? Is it B? Well, in this case, A and C. Is it A? Is it C? Or it depends who you ask, right? Because who measures first if two events are space-like separated depends on the observer. It's observer dependent. So this kind of collapse explanation is not satisfactory. So anyway, let me just go forward to, I'm not going to get on. This is because it didn't update for some reason. I don't know. Let me just quickly open this again. Yeah, somehow. OK, I go back. OK, I'm going to go through the topics that we're going to cover in the course. I'm going to start with a little bit of what I call relativistic quantum optics, which is, if you want, it's a mixture of algebraic quantum field theory with quantum optics. We're going to start with how do we measure quantum fields. We're going to talk a little bit about the light-matter interaction, and how and why sometimes the usual quantum mechanical way of addressing this is not enough, and quantum optics is not enough. We're going to talk about measuring quantum fields in particular and what we cannot really wave our hands and say things like, my qubit lives here, and things like that. We're going to talk about particular models, in particular the Andrew DeWitt. Oh, this W should be capital, by the way. And we're going to talk about signaling and communication with particle detectors. We're going to talk a lot about, something should be here, thermodynamics. We're going to talk about quantum field thermodynamics a little bit. We're going to talk about particle detectors and how thermodynamics plays a role. What does it mean to be in a thermal state for a quantum field and things like that? We're going to talk about the information loss problem and the Andrew effect. You're going to do is it homework or an assignment? I forgot.
For the Andrew effect?
Yeah.
Tutorial.
It's a tutorial, yeah. So you're going to have a tutorial on the Andrew effect. How many of you know about the Andrew effect? Good. And we're going to talk about the problems with the original derivation of the Andrew effect, the more modern derivations of the Andrew effect. We're going to talk about the vacuum entanglement structure, how the ground state of a quantum field contains entanglement between space-like separated regions, and why is this important. We're going to talk about how we can actually extract that entanglement, which is an application of it, which is something that is unintuitive until I tell you why. I mean, some of you may already know, if I've told you already. We're going to talk about, so entanglement harvesting is basically getting to, if you want, localized systems, like atoms, for example, that are space-like separated and completely uncorrelated. They interact with the field while they remain space-like separated, and they end up entangled without exchanging any information, without even knowing about each other. We're going to talk about communication in quantum field theory. We're going to see how information flows may not be associated with energy flows. I mean, oftentimes when people talk about communication, right, they say, oh, you exchange a quantum of the field, and that's communication. People talk about rays of light moving or particles traveling, and they carry the information, right? Maybe not. Maybe the information can travel without being supported by particles, if you want, by energy transmission. I will see about that. And we'll apply it to cosmology. We're going to talk about quantum energy teleportation. Quantum energy teleportation is about unlocking zero-point energy, if you want. Can I get a ground state of a quantum field, do a local measurement here, and then, a local measurement, a local operation here. Say I do a local unitary, even, to make it simpler, here. And can I extract energy from it? The answer is no. No, you can't. If you do a local unitary, sometimes you're going to get energy out, sometimes you're going to get energy in. On average, you will not be able. That's going to have an energy cost, because obviously you're talking about the ground state. All that you can do to the ground state is increase its energy. However, we've talked about the ground state having entanglement. What about if someone makes a measurement somewhere else and then transmits the outcome of the measurement to someone else here, and that person uses that information to do a local unitary on the vacuum? Then that operation can extract energy. And you may think, oh, is it because that person put energy in and it traveled? No. It's because you are telling the person a lot about the vacuum fluctuations and how to do properly an operation there to extract energy, even for something that looks locally like the vacuum. Of course, you can extract less than the energy that was put in. You're not violating any energy conservation here. But it's super important. And it can create negative stress energy densities. And that has implications, and we will discuss them as well. So, any questions? I'm going to disconnect this, by the way, and use the boards now. Any questions so far? All right. So let's discuss a little bit then about the measurement problem. Let's begin the discussion about the measurement problem. Let's see if I can do front down here. Okay, so let's talk about choke is not okay. Projective measurements.
How do they work?
Well, so you have some quantum system. So here we're gonna talk about systems and measurement apparatuses, right? That's the usual way in which people talk in quantum mechanics about measurements. So you have a quantum system. In a state rho s, right? And doing a projective measurement is like, well, you apply some measurement apparatus to it. And then you get an outcome of this. Say the outcome is k of some observable. You measure the value k for some observable. And then the state is updated, and it becomes now a projector over k rho s projector over k. And of course, you renormalize, right? So this is the usual rule when you do projective measurements. And what you get if, say that the measurement is rank one, meaning we know the value. It's not that we know the value is between this and this, it's rather we know it's k. So that means the projector p k is rank one, where this is the eigenstate of eigenvalue k of the observable you measured. Then what you get in the end is that the system is in a pure state. Well, let's do density matrix anyways. Right? So that's the way projective measurements work. Agreed, everyone? OK. Pros and cons. Who can tell me pros of this? No, well, come on, there are pros. I mean, people were very clever, were thinking about this to model measurements. There's a reason for it. Pros.
Simple.
It's simple. That's a nice pro. It's super simple. What else? No one? Yeah.
Same basis again, you should get the same outcome.
There you go. So, for some, or many, let's say many even, many controllable experiments seemed like a good description. Right? That's why people used it. It's because, yeah, it seems that that's what you get. Right? Okay, those are the pros. What about the cons? Who knows cons of it? Yeah?
It's non-unitary state evolution.
Ah, nice. So if we had something like, I don't know, let's just do this. Let's just think of it. I'm gonna write something that looks like a circuit, please, not a circuit. But say that you have, so what it's doing here, it's separating detectors or measurement apparatuses from quantum systems. See what I mean? It's like, whatever makes the measurement, so you see that now we say, oh, gravity, we don't know how the quantum theory of gravity would be, or how quantum gravity is even quantum or not. That would be carried to this case. It's like, oh, we know about quantum systems, but what we don't know measurement, the theory of measurement apparatuses. Measurement apparatuses, who knows? They're probably not quantum, if you actually believe this. And the thing is that you start, so if you consider that your measurement apparatus can be quantum, then you start with a system, and then you have a measurement apparatus, let's call it D for device, right? And then these two things, you do a measurement here, and that measurement returns an outcome K. Let's say K, you measure an observable with the measurement apparatus, right? You measure an observable k on the system S. So the measurement apparatus is in a very definite state, because it's like the gauge is pointing at k, so it's telling you exactly it's at k. So in itself, there will be an observable in the apparatus, a gauge observable, if you want, a pointer variable is what it's called, that will evolve to an eigenstate, right? Say k, or whatever represents k in the apparatus, right? So this thing will evolve to, so you start in a tensor product state. Say they're uncorrelated at the beginning. Your apparatus you brought from home and your system is there. And then this thing evolves to the eigenstate k for the system and whatever represents the eigenstate k for the apparatus in a tensor kind of state, because they both have definite values. Agreed, people? This is what the projective measurement is doing for you. Now, this thing cannot be quantum. This thing, there's no, in the sense of, there is no Hamiltonian. There's no way of making these two things interact that will end up with something like this, because this cannot be unitary evolution. You cannot describe the apparatus system. And then if you say environment or whatever, well, you can do something very similar with an environment in here. And sometimes you will get the right results. Of course, sometimes there can be an environment that makes it look like this, as in like put all the entropy in the environment and purify these two subsystems. But that is very particular cases. In general, it will not be able to do it. So this thing cannot be described by, if you want, unitary interactions. So that's a very important problem, because again, he's saying that you have something magical, if you want, that it's called a measurement apparatus that has the property of giving definite values and projecting or purifying any state of the system to a particular pure state with a definite value of an observable. Now, what happens in reality, let's see, front, I'm going to try to put the middle here. See what happens. Nothing happens. OK. In that case, what's that?
The next one.
Nice, thank you. That's going to go all the way up, I think, though, which is sad. All right. Bad idea. OK, good. So let's see what happens in reality, if you want, in reality. Like, if we consider that our measurement apparatus is quantum as well. So there, we say the rules of quantum mechanics also apply to my measurement apparatus, right? It's like, well, measurement apparatuses, after all, are made of the same matter that I'm trying to describe with quantum theory, so better be part of quantum theory. So you would get, let's do the ways, like how measurements work. OK, so you have step one. I've been told that you've seen POVMs, right? So of course, the good description would be a POVM. And we'll see how that comes about. Step one, you start with a system, rho S, and then a detector, or an apparatus, right, rho D. OK, and of course, you start from, if you want, yeah, I'm going to do it. You start from rho SD being an uncorrelated state of the system, and maybe the detector first. Nah, system first. And the detector. OK? So you start from that. You have like my detector here, my system here. I'm going to do a measurement. They start uncorrelated. Agreed, everyone? This is a completely uncorrelated state. It's also called a product state, which means no correlation, neither quantum or classical. OK. Then I couple the system and the detector through some unitary operation. I apply some U, let's call it U, that couples the two. And this thing evolves to a system that is U, rho SD, U, that, right? And then you say, OK, my measurement apparatus is a bit special. Of course, it's a measurement apparatus. This is not any quantum system. It's a system that I chose to make measurements with, which means I can control it. I can definitely have a description of what it is to read out a value from it. See what I mean? It's a system that you assume you can measure, projectively, maybe. You can do a projective. We saw projective measurements describe sometimes processes very well. For some systems under control, imagine that I assume that I'm able to projectively measure the apparatus. OK? We'll talk about that, because there's a little bit of sweeping under carpet here, but Let's talk about that at the end. Let's assume that I have my quantum system that it could be any state, it could be very non-controllable, and I can do a measurement by coupling a detector system, which is something controllable, something nice, something that I can do projective measurements with some security they work on. All right, so the next thing I do, make a projective measurement on the apparatus. OK? So if you do that, then you go from USD U dagger, you go to, OK, nice. So what I'm going to do now is apply nothing on the system and a projective measurement on the apparatus, right? And then I have rho SD U dagger. And then I apply a projective measurement on the apparatus, same thing, right? It's the other side of the same thing. And of course, I need to renormalize this. So you have identity on the system, projective measurement on the apparatus. Right? And of course, the projective measurements returns a value k. So this is the projector associated with the value k. All right? So that means that the state of the, let me make sure I'm getting the same, the state of the system now, so the update rule for the whole system is this, right? The state, if I call this rho SD prime, the update rule is that the system goes from rho S to the trace over D of rho SD prime, which is not guaranteed at all to be a pure state. Okay? And in general, this is something you can do in a lab. That's the way you do measurements in the lab. And PVMs in general don't describe what happens. This can cover any case. If you want to have an environment, then put the environment inside the D. The result of this is a POVM. I'm not going to get into, like, it's a POVM. You can define the POVM elements. And some of you have done that, actually. That was an assignment of my quantum course, right? Some of you have actually computed the measurement elements of this POVM. And prove that this thing can always be modeled as a POVM. OK, so basically, what this thing does, if we do the circuit or pseudo-circuit kind of approach, is we start with something like this. And then we make the two systems interact unitarily, right? And then the state here is, if you want, an entangled state in general. Let me just write rho SD. It's in general an entangled state. And then what we do is on the partial system, we do a measurement. And that measurement returns a value k. Okay. And this measurement on the global system, what it does is returns a rho S prime. Okay. And of course, for the projective measurements, let's not cut it. The projective measurement returns a k for the detector. All right. Well, no. But yeah, at the end, the whole projective measurement is something like this. You have that state. So the point here is that we are singling out systems called detectors. I mean, in both cases, we're singling out detectors, right? In case number one, we're saying detectors are magical things that quantum mechanics don't apply to that can extract a value, a classical value, out of a quantum system, and then makes it state in an eigenstate of the observed observable. Whereas in here, what we're doing is detectors are also quantum systems. And those quantum systems have to couple in some way to the probed system. And that coupling has some effect on the system. And then I can read out a detector. A detector is something special in the sense that I can read it out. I can do PVMs that are good descriptions, and I can read it out. And that has an effect on the system. The system, in general, evolves like this. Sometimes this will be a projective measurement. Sometimes it will be a pure state. That is when the D, that includes an environment, if you want, puts kind of all the entropy on that entanglement, moves the entanglement in here. Right, the moment you have entanglement, you're going to have a partial state that is mixed, right? So somehow maybe the unitary that's doing here is putting all that entanglement into environment. OK, maybe. But the whole point, though, is that this is what is in general, is not a pure state on the system at the end. And it is certainly covering all the possible cases. Now, the sweeping under carpet, who can tell me where the sweeping under carpet went here? There's a sweeping under carpet that is pretty big, which is like, hold on, how do you, so, OK, fine. So you're telling me that to read out quantum systems, you need detectors, which are other quantum systems. Agreed, people? But what I write in my experimentalist notebook, in the end, is at 42, the outcome of a measurement. Agreed, people? How do you read out the detector? What is the measurement applied on the detector? How do you measure the detector? I'm kind of escalating the problem of where do I do what is called the quantum to classical transition. One level up. See what I mean? I can actually do, oh, OK, yeah, couple other things to the. You can be fully quantum here and say, yeah, the way to read out the detector is I couple something else to the detector that is also quantum, like, I don't know, my retina or something. Or no, the electromagnetic field, right? And then that couples back to my retina, and there's a chain of detectors here. And where does the thing end? See what I mean? So this is a problem. It's an open problem if you want. That's kind of why the mechanism that makes you write a 42 eventually, or takes the computer to that. No, I'm not talking about free will or minds or anything like that. I'm not. I'm talking about the outcome being classical when we accept in our model of reality that the outcome, the computer finds a 42, right? Something like that. That is an open problem. It's called the measurement problem for a reason. It's an open problem in quantum theory. We have several solutions to these kinds of things, or proposed solutions, if you want. But I'm not going to get into them. One of them is to say that measurements really don't happen. And that's actually a very elegant way. By that, I mean when you do experiments in reality, you don't do one experiment. To declare a physical value, you do many experiments. And you have errors in those experiments, right? So you have statistical errors in those experiments. So maybe the classical value is just an emergent property of doing many experiments. Maybe there's no such thing as a single-shot experiment. There's a single-shot event that I cannot describe in quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics only applies to ensembles of things. In the end, to declare a physical measurement, you need to do many measurements. That is called, by the way, the ensemble interpretation of quantum mechanics. Leslie Ballantyne would be one of the main proponents of those. It's very elegant in the sense that it's minimalistic. There's no, how to call it, BS involved, is saying like, well, this is as much as we can describe. How not say that all that we can have is many experiments. One experiment is not a thing. We have many experiments. To talk about a value, you need to do the thing many times in physics. So yeah, that's the way it works. It's just ensembles. There's no single, and therefore you don't need anymore to talk about when do you go from quantum to classical, because the classical value 42 emerges out of the statistics. That's a solution. There are many others. We can talk about the coherence-based solutions. There's even Bohmian solutions to it. I don't know how much you want to call it a solution, but there are Bohmian approaches to this. I'm not going to discuss them, though. For now, what we're going to start taking from here is that we are going to treat detectors as quantum systems that are controllable enough for projective measurements to be a good model for measurement of them. See, that is way more powerful than that. Because we're not assuming here that there's some magical projection that you do. And who knows what? What you have, no, I have another quantum system that measures the first system, and that quantum system is controllable. It's not any, the system you measure could be any quantum system, the detector you choose. You don't choose nature, that's S. You choose what you use as detector. And you are not going to be stupid, and you're going to pick a system for which the simplest way, the pro here that is simple, the simple way of measuring works pretty well. That doesn't mean that there are caveats here. But it's much better than applying projective measurements. Questions? So far, so good. All this should be familiar with you already. Now, the problem comes, and this is going to be the beginning of the next lecture. Problem comes when we want to do relativity on top of this. If we want to do these kinds of things, with quantum field theory. There's a big problem with it, and the problem was first identified by someone local, here, which is Raphael Sorkin. The problem, let me just have a couple references here. The name is not an archive, the name is Impossible Measurements in Quantum Fields. And this is an old 9302018 is from 1993. Many other things have been, like Faye Dawker and other people, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, have done more on this. But the problem is that, well, projective measurements are even worse when you are in quantum field theory. Basically, what Raphael Sorkin says, and this is a quote. Oh, no, the quote comes later. What Raphael Sorkin says is, if you allow for projective measurements to exist in a quantum field theory, you introduce violations of causality. You can signal just through allowing the existence of measurement. And people may say, oh, sir, I'm not, sir, I mean, come on. When I do a projective measurement in my quantum optics lab and I say, I'm measuring energy of the photon, I know that I'm kind of doing a measurement of something that is completely localized, right? An eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, the free Hamiltonian of the field, if that exists. Is an eigenstate that is delocalized in space, right? Because it's got a definite momentum, so it's localized in space. And say, yeah, it's not that we measure wave packets and so on. No, 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 no. It's way more fundamental than this. Projective measurements, even localized projective measurements, if you pick a local observable of the field, something that lives only here, and you do projective measurements, you allow projective measurements on local observables of the field, you are destroying the causality of the theory. The problem is not how localized your projective measurement is that it exists, the projective measurements. Even if it's localized, projective measurements, PVMs, destroy causality. PVMs, the existence of projective measurements, implies that the quantum field theory is no longer a proper quantum field theory. It's no longer relativistic. You've destroyed the causality of the theory. It's incompatible with relativity. Let me just quote, because this has consequences, and Raphael Sorkin says, this leaves the Hilbert space formulation of quantum field theory with no measurement theory. How strong that is. Keep in mind that measurement theory is kind of postulated at the level of quantum mechanics. Here, we still have Born's rule. So you see, what is the, Born's rule talks about probabilities of things happening, right? If you cannot project, how do you use Born's rule? What's the interpretation of Born's rule, right? Think about it. This is super deep. Think about it. And it's a problem you kind of want to take home, which is like, OK, if you cannot do projective measurements in quantum field theory, what can you do? Because people do. You hear about new particles being found, and that kind of sounds like measurements in quantum field theory, no? What the heck are they doing then? See what I mean? This is a very fundamental problem, and it's a horrible problem. I mean, just read the paper. It's kind of nice. Or read, even better, read this one first. It's kind of an introduction. This one by Faye Dawker. I love Faye Dawker. That is called, actually, if I remember well, it's called, I'm not going to write it because I'm not sure of the literarity of this, but it's Useless Qubits in Relativistic Quantum Information. Really nice, provocative paper. It's basically saying, hey, dudes, read Sorkin in a very nice way. 1111.2308, 2011. And if you want a more rigorous analysis with other, not complete, but Benincasa et al., also Faye Dawker, Classical and Quantum Gravity, 31075007, 2014. You want to read a bit more about that. But the whole point about this is, and I'll discuss a little bit a very hand-wavy way of going through that. I'll try to minimize hand-waviness, but time is finite. So with this particular statement, I'll do a hand-wavy example only. Still an example. Projective measurements in quantum field theory are not OK. If you do anything, if you hear people talking about a quantum field theory and say, oh yeah, we measure a local observable of the field, then you have to tell them, hold on, what do you mean measure? Because if they imply that they're going to get a value 42 somehow out of this on the field, just talking about quantum field theory, that is incompatible with quantum field theory. Any questions? We'll get into that tomorrow. And we're going to talk about how we solve this problem and how actually things work in reality, because we are measuring quantum fields all the time, no? Like, are you seeing me right now? That is measuring a quantum field, no? So what the heck, how does that work? How is that compatible with this fundamental statement? That we will deal with tomorrow. Questions or anything? I would love if this could be like a kind of debate. I make like outrageous statements, no? Sometimes. So please combat them. Hopefully, I mean, I know that Aggie will, I hope, right? Because next year you did and it was nice. But I would love for you to like tell me, come on, what do you mean? No. That would be nice. Anyway, I think I'm done. See you tomorrow.